welcome to this episode of Fossils and Fiction, a podcast that explores the stories of prehistoric life, most often through the stories we humans tell about it. It's produced by me, Travis Holland, with support from Charles Sturt University. Enjoy. Hi, Adele. Welcome to my podcast. This is the second time you've been on, but reintroduce yourself and your work for me.
Yeah, so for anyone who hasn't listened to the episode that we did last year, my name's Adele Pentland. My pronouns are she, her. I do my work on Kaur Country in central western Queensland. So I live in a really remote area. But Winton is sort of known as the dinosaur capital of Australia. So in terms of my work, there's no better place to be. And I'm a part-time PhD candidate. I'm now with Curtin University. So I think last time we spoke, I was at Swinburne University of Technology. I've now moved to follow my supervisor, Dr. Steve Porapat, because he has a new role with Curtin. And I'm also a research associate at the Australian Age of Dinosaurs Museum of Natural History. And I mainly work on pterosaurs, but I'm also a bit of a trader and I work on dinosaurs a little bit as well.
A bit of a trader to pterosaurs. I love that.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Because they're not the same thing.
Adele, no, you are just about Australia's foremost pterosaur expert, I think.
Thank you.
In my reading of the situation.
Yeah, so I named a new species in 2019 and I've published 6 papers as lead author on pterosaurs, and I also help co-author papers on dinosaurs as well. But my most recent one was 2 little bones from Victoria. They're the geologically oldest pterosaurs in Australia, not by a huge margin. But they were living in polar regions, and one of them was just a juvenile with a wingspan of just 1 meter compared to Ferrodraco, the new species I named in 2019, that has a 4 meter wingspan.
Well, I've invited you on the podcast today for an entirely different reason, but if you want to talk about those pterosaurs, I'm happy to hear it. Tell us about that newest one.
Yeah, so I think the paper came out in, I believe it was May. Those bones were discovered 30 or so years ago through dinosaur dreaming. A lot of effort was made to collect those fossils because they're from Dinosaur Cove, which is a site that was excavated basically through a 24/7 small-scale mining operation to dynamite into the side of an unnamed cove at the time, which has now been called Dinosaur Cove. And yeah, they've been sitting in the collections at Melbourne Museum for years and years, and I got to work on them, which was really nice.
I think it's always a super cool story when somebody says, hey, these bones have been sitting around for a while, but nobody's done anything with them. What are they? And so you get to come along and bring your work to it, which, you know, sometimes it's just that confluence of being available with the resources being around. And there it is, where it wasn't there, you know, maybe when they were pulled out of the ground in the first place.
Yeah, there's definitely moments of serendipity, and it has to do with sort of being in the right place at the right time, but also showing that you're interested as well. And yeah, the more papers that I do, the more people know that I work on pterosaurs, and I guess have faith that I'll also do like a really good job describing the fossils that they have.
Now, last time I had you on the podcast, it was to talk about the research, and we've just had a little bit more of a preview of what you've been up to since then. But since then, you went and launched your own podcast, Pals in Paleo, which I absolutely love. You're not all that far through in terms of the series run, although you're rapidly catching me, and certainly you've already overtaken me in listeners, because you're a real-life paleontologist. I'm just some goob with a microphone. So what's the thinking behind doing a podcast for you?
Oh, that's very kind of you to say. I'm not sure if I'm catching you in terms of listeners, I think I underestimated just how much work goes into a podcast, and it's given me a new appreciation for the podcasts that I listen to. But I've been toying with the idea of starting a podcast since I was an undergrad student in 2014. But yeah, after almost 10 years, the idea for a podcast never really went away. I'm super passionate about working on fossils and getting them out on display to the public. And I've been really fortunate to do that through working with small regional museums in Outback Queensland, which is where I'm based. And yeah, I just generally want to show the world that we have some incredible fossils here in Australia. I think for a long time, people have sort of turned their nose up at Australian paleontology, and I just kind of want to combat that. I was thinking about starting a podcast since last year and was starting to work on some bits and pieces, but I also went to a science conference this year called Science Meets Parliament in Canberra. It was an incredible experience, and I got to attend through the regional and remote scholarship. And I met doctors and professors from all different facets of science, and some of them just had no idea we have dinosaurs and fossils here in Australia. So it was really heartbreaking. And I personally would die happy if kids in Australia love the dinosaurs and fossils we find here in Australia as much as they love, you know, the ones from North America, Triceratops, T-Rex, all of those. But the first step to getting towards that is that they have to know this stuff exists first. So yeah, Pals and Paleo is trying to celebrate underrated fossils and just make that information accessible.
Would you say that's the real focus of the podcast, Australian fossils? I know you recently had the episode on Douglasius, and mostly that's found outside Australia, I think, or maybe all.
Yes.
But before that, you were talking about some other Australian fossils as well. So what's the kind of main focus there? Or are you just going with, as you say, underrated things that people don't talk about enough?
Yeah, so I think because I'm a paleontologist and I've done all my uni here in Australia, most of what I know is on Australian paleontology. So I think for me, initially, it's been just trying to stick with what I know. But I also just don't want the podcast to purely be on pterosaurs or focus too heavily on dinosaurs and vertebrate paleontology. The podcast for me is also a way for me to kind of learn a little bit more about fossils that I've been familiar with for a few years. But yeah, in terms of goals, like other than to be consistent and release episodes that are full of good information and easy to listen to, it's just about making the science accessible, which kind of goes hand in hand with my research. Again, like I just want people to be interested in paleontology in general. And yeah, if I can do that through talking about a bunch of different fossils, then yeah, hopefully people from overseas as well will gain an appreciation for the stuff we find here in Australia.
Yeah. A lot of what you've also jumped or turned up on a lot of other podcasts. I noticed you're on Beyond Blathers, and your work was mentioned on Common Descent, which is one of my favorite podcasts. I think you've been on a bunch of others as well. Is that part of your strategy to get science communication happening more broadly? Jumping on other people's podcasts?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because, I've been on I Know Dino a couple times before I started Pals and Paleo, as well as Paleocast. Again, more to talk about the research side of things. We're in a very unique situation where we're not really competing against each other through podcasting, right? Normally, you know, once you find a new show, potentially from that host being a guest on someone else's show, then it's just a win-win situation for everyone. But yeah, podcasts are just super accessible. I mean, for me personally, I'll go through phases where I'll listen to hours of podcasts in a day, particularly if I'm spending time on the tractor or doing something like that. You can listen to them when you're commuting, when you're exercising, you're doing chores. It's just an easy way to digest information, you know, without having to read a book or a scientific article.
Yeah, I find when I've got lots of hours of driving coming up ahead of me, I line up, you know, 9-10 hours of podcast episodes to listen through and smash through all at once, which is great. What role do you
think that podcast...
Yeah, yeah. And I guess being in regional areas, you're more remote than me, but being in regional areas, that helps because often we do have to face those long drives. Mm. Sometimes I feel like the podcasters you listen to become like friends and you get to feel like you know them. Yes. And there's this weird sort of parasocial thing happening sometimes. But this all comes from my expertise, right? You talk about fossils all day and I talk about media and how people relate to it. But sometimes it's nice to have voices rather than just the same songs or the same sorts of songs playing over and over, I find.
Yeah. It's very much like a one-way conversation in a lot of ways. Like I'll even be listening to a podcast, but then I'll begin talking about a point that I know. They can't hear me, obviously. Mm-hmm. It's totally just for myself, but I totally get what you mean. And it was really interesting. I went to a conference for paleontology about 3 or so weeks ago now. And yeah, there was one research, I think she's an honors student. She came up to me and yeah, I think she just really had the sense that she knew me because she listened to the podcast.
Do you think we're just talking to people who are already interested? How do you actually go about attracting a new audience to this kind of stuff?
Yeah, it's a really good question and it's a tough one as well. I really guess it depends on how you're attracting new audiences. And this is something that I sort of think about and worry about a little bit because the language that you'd use to talk to someone who is already interested in paleontology versus someone who's a skeptic and they think that all fossils are fake, and there's no such thing as dinosaurs, depending on who you're talking to, you'll communicate in two totally different ways. And I've given up on being all things to all people. Not everyone will like me. And that's totally okay. Like I've made peace with that. That's not to say I don't try to attract new audiences. Obviously by having guests on, that can really help reach new audiences. And also talking about fossils from different groups helps. But for me, I'm pretty clear on like, who I want my audience to be and what they value. I'm just trying to focus on putting out episodes and growing the Pals and Paleo Instagram. Sometimes I'll mention that there's a new episode out on Twitter, but because it's mostly paleontologists that follow me there, it's not really like a big priority either. Instagram is really nice because it's such a visual platform that I find that I can then sort of like link back to it on the podcast. So if something I'm talking about isn't clear, then hopefully they can see a photo of it on Instagram.
It's one of the real challenges with audio in, I've been grappling with this question as I'm trying to write some things about paleontology communication is the role of paleo art in paleontology is really central, more so than any other science, I think, that art is such a central role. And then you go, okay, but I'm just going to do this via audio without any visuals at all. So where do you link that together? So, it's an interesting challenge. And it's good that the social media can work hand in hand for you, I think.
Yeah.
What challenges do you face in science communication, Adele, or what challenges do science communicators face generally, do you think?
Oh, I mean, generally, I guess skepticism and also just bad information being presented in a way that seems very professional is like a really tough one. My situation is kind of unique. We touched on this before. For me, like, it would be great if I could do more school visits and talks in person, but I live in an extremely remote area. So my closest neighbors are 13 kilometers or 8 miles away, and our nearest town is 130 kilometers away or 80 miles away. So, you know, there's only so many school visits I can do in the district, if I were to drive out to each one. So for me, technology and being able to put out content online is like a really key way to sort of doing science communication for me personally. And I'm trying to do more like Zoom talks with schools this year as well. But yeah, it's a hard one. I guess it really just depends on what audiences you want to talk to and stuff, and whether you want to try and persuade people who think science and paleontology is a joke, and, you know, impress upon them the importance of peer review and the scientific process and the scientific method. But again, I think you have to pick your battles at the end of the day.
Yeah, I'm glad you pointed that out, because you've mentioned the kind of skeptics a couple of times. And I wonder whether the skeptics are worth targeting in a sense, right? You've got the people who've made up their mind that they just are never going to listen. You've got the people who love the science, and perhaps there's people in the middle or who are on the edges who are the ones we can bring in and reach with, you know, various science communication activities.
Yeah. One of my friends who sort of helped out with the podcast as well, Cesar Pushmar, and he has a podcast called Death by Birding, and he often cites, I think it's David Attenborough, people won't protect something that they're not familiar with or don't come into contact with. So I think you're right. It's probably easier to, I guess, sort of cozy up to people who are sort of borderline and they're interested but aren't necessarily diehard fans. It's probably easier to get them on board with what we're doing. But I used to work as a tour guide at the Australian Native Dinosaurs Museum of Natural History. And occasionally you do get people in there who, as you're doing your tour, they're saying in hushed tones to their kids that this is from the Great Flood and this is this and this is that. But occasionally those people do come through, and the tour guides there do a really good job, and they've actually been able to change the minds of some of those people too. So it's not a losing fight as well, but it is difficult to do.
Yeah, I love that optimism, actually. I really appreciate hearing that, the notion that, because I kind of, I haven't worked in that field, so I would kind of not have expected anyone with those set beliefs to even come to a dinosaur museum, or to even, you know, if that's the perspective. So it shows that they are willing to listen, and if you reach out and try and provide good information and get them excited and enthused, then that can go a long way. Yeah, that's really nice. What are some of your strategies for communicating effectively, for reaching out to people?
Oh, in terms of the nitty gritty, I tend to go on tangents quite a lot, and there are times when I'll be doing an interview.
You were singing on a recent episode.
Oh no, I had planned to do that. cite a good old meme. For me, I will write out bullet points, because sometimes I'll lose track of where I was going with something. So bullet points are pretty key for me. And then this has less to do with the podcast, but more to do with if I'm giving a presentation at uni or at a conference, I also do something called scripting. So if I've got a big talk to do at a conference, even if it's like 15 or 20 minutes long, I'll basically rehearse what I'm going to say and how I'm going to say it. So that way, when nerves kick in, I can still do it with a smile on my face, because that's what I've been practicing. And it just means that I know I won't talk over time or finish 5 or 10 minutes early or something like that, and then feel even more stressed. Scripting for me also helps with pacing. So we all know that when you're nervous, you talk a little bit faster than you would normally, but then that can make it harder for people to follow along with what you're saying. But if you've practiced, you're a little bit more likely to talk clearly and enunciate, which is really helpful when you're using jargon. And ultimately, if you have great content, but you haven't presented it well and people can't understand what you're saying, then the message won't come across. Now, scripting isn't for everyone. For me, that's how my brain works. It really helps a lot. When I'm doing podcast episodes, I will listen back to everything and I'm quite picky about like what gets through. Sometimes I'll have a go at the same thing 5 or 6 times until the energy levels are there. I'm a big believer that when people can see that you're enjoying what you're presenting, they will enjoy it as well. So I actually do the podcast and I try to smile a lot of the time because people can hear it in your voice. It sounds really dorky. I sound like a complete wiener by saying this, but I think those like 1% of things make a difference genuinely. And then no matter what you're doing, whether you're doing a podcast, whether you're giving a presentation to like 1 person or 100 people, use your voice effectively. Don't speak at a wall. You know, I'm squared up to my mic at the moment. Try and make sure I'm in the Goldilocks zone, not too close, not too far away. And moderate your tone as well, because that keeps your audience's attention. And then, yeah, for me, if you're doing something in person, try and read the room, gauge what your audience is thinking by what expression is on their face. And yeah, try and have open body language as well. Just those things make a big difference.
That's actually some really, really awesome tips. Have you done some media training or something? Because that sounds like the kinds of things that you get through media training.
I haven't actually done media training. I had to think about that. So I did theater. I did like the school production and stuff when I was in high school, which is probably where I picked up the blocking and the voice and making sure you're facing your audience and not talking away. I think working as a tour guide at the museum was like a big part of how I sort of see science communication. I've participated in 3-minute theses, which is a competition for PhD students to present their thesis, you know, 70,000, 100,000 words and sum it up in 3 minutes for a general audience. I think that has been super helpful and like formative to how I see science communication. I've participated in FameLab as well, which isn't just for PhDs. It's sort of open, I guess, to scientists in general. Similar kind of concept, communicate your science for 3 minutes. And I was I think I was a Queensland semi-finalist for that. But now I've gotten to do a little bit of judging for FameLab as well. So I guess these are just things that I've just kind of noticed and I'm generally aware of. But in terms of media training, I've done press releases before and through being a research associate at Australian Age of Dinosaurs, I kind of got some, you know, training and tips from David Elliott and Trish Sloan, who I think you've had on the podcast before on Fossils in Fiction. They're my big mentors and have kind of really helped like shape how I see science communication. But yeah.
That's awesome. And finally, I couldn't let you get away without asking this question. I know you have lots of pop culture interests and they pop up throughout Pals and Paleo. Your Simpsons references are legendary. And I say that as a certified Simpsons expert. There was a period where every time there was a story about the Simpsons in the Australian media, I was getting called to do an interview. How do you go ahead and blend science with culture?
That's so awesome that you're the go-to person for Simpsons references.
Yeah, it was wild. It was a weird period.
That's awesome. For me, that's how my brain works. I'm one of those insufferable people who something will come up and my brain will just want to quote a movie or a TV show. When I'm in field work with my PhD supervisor, my boss, the number of times I'll say, dig up stupid. But no, for me, like we've sort of touched on this before.
That's such a good line for paleontology.
Just me being absolutely insufferable. When I'm trying to describe some weird plant or animal that someone hasn't seen before, it's a bit of a challenge. So yeah, for pop culture references in general, if I can paint someone a picture and reference something that they've seen before, and it ties everything together in a way that's memorable and sticks in their brain, job done. But because I also record a lot on my own, without anyone to bounce off of, I find that the pop culture references like keeps things interesting, because I do tend to try and jam in a lot of scientific information, but I don't want to have it so that it's really dense. So the pop culture references break things up. And I don't know, like, science doesn't happen in a vacuum. I've had guests on, and without me prompting them, they've mentioned Jurassic Park, Walking with Dinosaurs, and how it captured their imagination when they were kids. So, yeah, it's just nice to kind of acknowledge that for a lot of people, their first introduction into the world of paleontology is through pop culture. So it's nice to be able to, yeah, tie things together with something they've already seen before.
I nearly got through a whole episode without a mention of Jurassic Park. So I'm almost tempted just to cut out that comment, but I'm sure people get fed up with me talking about Jurassic Park.
You can't not. I don't know. One of my really good mates, like, we recorded, and I haven't released this episode yet, but yeah, he's diehard Jurassic Park fan, and before he studied paleontology, he studied genetics. It's so funny.
Well, that's quite the link, isn't it? This is a really rude question, but can I ask your age? I don't think I've ever asked you
your age. Yeah, no, that's fine. I'm 29. I'm turning 30 next month. Okay. As of this recording.
Okay. So you are, the reason I asked that is you are then basically in that millennial zone, because I teach the Gen Zs, the school leavers, and the Simpsons references just totally fall flat with them. So, but you're still kind of on that millennial train, which is great.
So Steve, who is my PhD supervisor, my boss, who I say dig up stupid to, even though I probably shouldn't, he's even noted to me, he's like, your references are a little bit older than what I would have expected, but I have an older brother who's 4 years older than I am. So that's what I put it down to. Yeah.
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah, no, that totally makes sense. Cause I thought you were younger than that, to be honest. And I was totally confused when you kept referring to classic Simpsons stuff. Give me a 30-second pitch for Pals in Paleo, why people should go out and listen.
Okay. So Pals in Paleo, we try and describe the form, function, and family groupings of different fossils. Often I get distracted. I think I've had a whinge about Pokemon. Jurassic Park has come up. There's a lot of good science in there, and I try my best to also write transcripts for each episode and make sure that the scientific spelling is right. But yeah, if you want to listen to a podcast made by a paleontologist who most of the time knows what they're talking about, but is also human and not perfect, check out the podcast. And yeah, if I stuff something up, I'll try and I guess make a mention of it in a later episode and clear things up.
I couldn't have said it better myself. I love your show, Adele, and thank you for coming on to chat to me about it here on Fossils in Fiction. Thanks so much.
No worries. Thank you so much for having me back. It's been an absolute pleasure.